Looks like the settlement between states and the makers of OxyContin isn't quite so settled. From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor, in for David Brancaccio. The Justice Department has moved to block a major legal settlement between dozens of states and Purdue Pharma, the maker of the opioid OxyContin. The DOJ says the deal would unfairly shield the Sackler family, which owns Purdue, from future litigation. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
The Purdue Pharma settlement, which would resolve thousands of lawsuits related to the deadly opioid addiction epidemic, has been a contentious one. A federal judge in New York approved it earlier this month as part of a bankruptcy reorganization of Purdue. The company says the deal is worth more than $10 billion, $4.5 billion of which would come from the Sackler family. But the family is estimated to have made billions more from sales of the painkiller OxyContin. Two states and the District of Columbia, in addition to the Justice Department, have opposed granting the Sackler family immunity from future lawsuits as part of the settlement. Now the Justice Department is asking the presiding judge to halt the settlement's implementation pending an appeal. The department believes the deal is unconstitutional because it deprives opioid victims of the right to sue the Sacklers, which have not filed for bankruptcy. Purdue, in a statement, said it continues to believe the settlement deal is the best resolution possible. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Italy has become the first European nation to mandate all employees from the public and private sectors to show proof of vaccination, a negative test, or recovery from coronavirus in order to show up at work. The BBC's Mark Lowen has that story from Rome.
From the 15th of October, the approximately 23 million people employed in Italy's public and private sectors will be obliged to present a green pass when they show up for work. Failure to comply could carry suspension without pay and a hefty fine. The aim is to persuade the roughly 4 million workers who have not yet had the jab to do so. And despite relatively small protests, polls suggest the majority of Italians support the move. As the first country in the West to be overwhelmed by coronavirus, and with Europe's second highest number of deaths, Italy has erred on the side of caution throughout the pandemic, and the government is now mulling obligatory vaccinations for the whole population.
We are now on the third round of the Advanced Child Tax Credit. These are the monthly payments of up to $300 per child the government started paying out in July. The most recent round just hit bank accounts this week, and the program is set to expire in December. But a new national survey suggests that some low-income families may not actually be receiving this money. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher has more.
Low-income families might not get the advanced child tax credit if they're not required to submit a tax return. Jacob Golden is an economist and law professor at Stanford.
Generally, people have to file a tax return for the IRS to know their information.
The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says roughly 4 million children and their families might be missing out on the payments for that reason. Families can still get the credit by signing up online. Ashley Burnside with the Center for Law and Social Policy says the number of households getting payments each month is going up.
Which means that parents are signing up and more parents are getting reached as time goes on.
There might be an easier way going forward, Jacob Golden says. The IRS could use information from other safety net programs
and use that data to automatically enroll people in the child tax credit if it looks like they're eligible to get it.
Congress is currently taking that up in the budget bill, as well as the future of the child tax credit more broadly. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Today marks 43 years since the signing of the Camp David Accords, when Egypt and Israel agreed to a framework for peace. That peace, though, has been a cold one. Economic relations between the two countries exist, but are limited. Economic relations with the U.S., on the other hand, have grown. The U.S. agreed to provide billions of dollars in aid to both Egypt and Israel as part of the agreement, and that continues today. For more on the legacy of these accords, we're joined by Ambassador Martin Indyk, Distinguished Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also served as the U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Good morning, Ambassador.
Good morning.
As part of the Camp David Accords, the U.S. agreed to pay both Israel and Egypt billions in aid each year. How important was that? I mean, did the U.S. have to purchase peace in a sense? And is that going to be part of the formula should Israel and Palestinians ever reach an agreement?
That, looked at from one lens, could be seen as buying the peace. But it was a critical way of underwriting the risks that Israel and Egypt were taking, and it's now become kind of standard. Israeli economy has really grown to the point where it could probably pay for it itself. But it's become so intertwined that you have a situation in which all of that $3.8 billion is spent in the United States on acquiring the weapons that the United States provides Israel as part of maintaining the balance of power in the region. It's, in a sense, buying peace and subsidizing the American military-industrial complex. But the overall effect, and I think this is what people should bear in mind, is that it has stabilized a very volatile region.
Palestinian representatives were not at Camp David. And Jimmy Carter later wrote, you know, the peace with Egypt essentially removed an incentive for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. How do you see the legacy of Camp David and other agreements that did not include Palestinians as they relate to, you know, statehood and economic independence for Palestinians?
Yes, well, that's the very disappointing part of the peace process, is that it didn't lead in the end to comprehensive peace between Israel and all of its Arab neighbors, including the Palestinians. But significant progress was made with the Palestinians, not originally as a result of Camp David, but over time, and with Egypt's help, it produced the Oslo Accords, which provided for Palestinian self-rule in 40% of the West Bank, and then Israel withdrew from Gaza, and now Hamas has taken it over. But the economic story has been a pretty dismal one. The United States has been providing aid, with the exception of the Trump years, to the Palestinian Authority, and that has essentially been helping to keep the Palestinian economy on life support. The economic relationship necessarily depends on ending the conflict.
Ambassador Martin Indyk, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Ambassador Nick also has a new book coming out next month, Master of the Game, Henry Kissinger and the Art of Middle East Diplomacy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.